now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
And joining us in the studio today, it is The Times chief sports writer and VAR cheerleader, Matt Dickinson. Also with us, the digital sports editor for The Times and The Sunday Times, Tom Clark. Coming up, we're going to discuss the future of Eddie Howe. We'll ask whether it's okay to deliberately get yourself sent off if it saves the game for your team. And we'll see how long we can put off mentioning those dreaded three letters, VAR. But let's start with a positive. And one man dominates the headlines today after a record-breaking afternoon for the one and only Sergio Aguero. The front page of the game today reads Goal Machine Aguero, with an image of City's star striker bagging his hat-trick against Aston Villa yesterday in a 6-1 rout. It means Aguero now has 177 Premier League goals. That's more than any other foreign player. And his hat-trick at Villa Park was his 12th in the Premier League. And that is more than any other player. He is still 83 goals behind Alan Shearer's 260 Premier League goals, but is just 10 shy of Andy Cole's 187, which would put him third on the all-time list behind Shearer and Wayne Rooney, who has 208. The question is, where does Aguero then rank on the all-time list of Premier League strikers? Matt, where would you put him?
If we're talking all nationalities, he's up there, but I think, you know, Shearer, not just for his goal rate. I was lucky enough to see him when I covered Blackburn in their glory years, and there were times when you'd see him pick up the ball and just knew he was going to get a goal, even though he could still be 30 or 40 yards from goal. But just the way there was a certainty about him, those low drives from 20, 25 yards that I think he probably, I'd love to see the statistics, but I suspect he got more from outside the box than Aguero. And if you factor in, if he had gone to Manchester United at any time, whether it was before the Blackburn move when he was wanted, whether it was after the Blackburn move when he was wanted and went back to Newcastle, to his hometown club. But if he'd have joined Man United, who obviously were so dominant at that time, he probably would have got another 50 to 100 goals. So I think for all those reasons, Shearer has to be the top. For me, for across the Premier League time. But to be ahead of someone like Thierry Henry for Sergio Aguero is a phenomenal achievement.
Well, he has beaten Thierry Henry now in terms of goals. 175 Thierry Henry has in the Premier League, 177 now for Aguero. Would Henry be above Aguero, though, in your list?
Well, I think for his, on the aesthetics, we were talking about it. I think for consistency, Aguero is staggering. I think, you know, and he has scored one of the iconic Premier League goals, obviously, that goal to clinch the league title. He ticks so many, but he scores off both feet. I think a crucial thing I was thinking, you know, there's been probably a sort of 5-year span of the Premier League where he was probably the one player in our league that you thought would be coveted by any team, whether it's Real Madrid at their best, whether it's Barcelona at their best. You could instantly see him slot into any of the best teams in the world. But I think for aesthetics, my heart ends up going with Thierry Henry just because of the way he moved some of those goals, the beauty of some of his runs, and that brought a slightly different sort of versatility to Henry and to that Arsenal team that, yeah, I find I'm drawn to fractionally more than Aguero's incredibly prolific rate.
It is hard because we're comparing strikers who were different in their styles. But Tom, Matt has gone for Alan Shearer as his ultimate Premier League striker. Do you agree?
No.
Oh,
Henri all the way for me. I think he changed the Premier League. I'd never seen anything like him when I was watching him play. I think he had everything. And I think when you're considering strikers in the Premier League history, you look at overall ability, pace. I think he was a lot stronger than people give him credit for as well, Thierry Henry. I think he could rough it, you know, with teams lower down the league. And he was just incredibly special. I think Matt's point's an interesting one when you look at the three strikers we're talking about. I don't know whether it's just circumstance, but Aguero hasn't ever been linked or particularly strongly with a move away. Henry obviously left to join Barcelona. Potentially could have left during his Arsenal career for the big money moves at other times as well. I mean, I think that is an interesting point with Aguero. Would he get in the great teams of Barcelona, Real Madrid, elsewhere out of the Premier League, like Henri undoubtedly would have during his time? I'm not so sure.
Mm-hmm.
Matt obviously also talks about Shearer being wanted by United. I think that's a very valid point. I mean, you could argue that counts against him because he should have gone there and won a load more titles and scored more goals. If you're really ruthless as a striker, surely you make the move that's going to get you the most goals and the most medals.
Oh, sentimentality goes out the window for you.
No interest in sentimentality, particularly if you're going to be a Premier League striker. Henri all the way for me, and I'd put Aguero second.
Ooh, okay. And Shearer third?
Yeah.
Okay, Gregor, does Aguero top your list?
I think he does. I think
does he? Okay.
I think Alan Shearer would be the only player I would say is kind of could be above him. But I think I'm going with Aguero because I think, you know, he missed a lot of football. He's had some injuries and he scored a goal every 106 minutes. Henri was 121. So he's a striker's job is to score goals. We can talk about how graceful Thierry Henry was to watch. And Shearer was just ridiculously lethal as well. But I think the way Aguero takes his chances, just as if he's played through on goal, it's a goal. There's no, he's so powerful, so kind of squat and explosive. It's been interesting hearing people talking about him over the last couple of days. Lescott saying that he's kind of, Julian Lescott, his former teammate, saying that he just concentrated on striking the centre of the ball every time. And you can see that in the way he shoots. The goal, the famous goal, the Aguero moment. Imagine the pressure. Imagine the rush of blood at that moment. And he has that kind of ability that the best strikers do, to kind of slow down time, be so cool and calm, and just rifle the ball in the near post.
Yeah, I mean, Henri had that as well, though. Henri had that as well. And I think Matt's point about his, you know, his grace and his French flair, and it almost counts against him, I think, with Henri, when you're considering that kind of deadly, you know, striker quality.
But I think equally, you know, Shearer, and you know, over a long period, but there was, you know, Shearer, there were. You know, particularly a few seasons. I mean, he was prolific across a long time, but there were, I think there were a few years, and particularly, I remember watching Blackburn week after week, and it was breathtaking, the reliability of, you know, of his shooting from any distance. He wouldn't just, you know, it could be headers, it could be 5 yarders, but even from say 20 yards, he would get the ball, and you just knew that ball was going to fly into the either bottom corner, top corner. It was just, it was almost sort of robotically accurate. And so it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the passage of time, you know, you sort of think, well,
Has the game changed a bit too? You know, is the Premier League more kind of more competitive now than it was when Shearer was playing?
Well, although it'd be a chance rate. I mean, obviously Blackburn did not dominate games with 80% possession like Man City can, and I'm not saying that to undermine Aguero's rate at all, but you know, I don't think, you know, again, I think you're right, Tom. It would have been fascinating, you know, to see. I think he should have gone to easy for us to say. He's pretty sure on his own decisions. I would have been fascinated to see, had he gone to Man United, what, you know, they would have probably dominated by more, and we'd have you know, that wouldn't have been great for the competition. But you know, to do it for Blackburn Rovers is a heck of a thing in itself.
Yeah, lots of Newcastle fans screaming at their phones with their headphones on at the moment. Very, very angry at me.
But what about Aguero then, in general? Tom, you've spoken a lot about Henri, and I have to say, I think I'm with you with Henri. There's just something about Thierry. What assets, you know, how great a player is Sergio Aguero?
I mean, it's, I think Gregor made an interesting point earlier about that goal against Queen's Park Rangers to win the title. The bit about that goal that fascinates me is not so much the finish. It's that in that moment, he dropped the shoulder, I think, twice to beat two guys lunging at him. And it's like he knows, you know, you hear a lot of experts and former players talk about, you know, knowing in your head one move ahead. To me, Aguero knows about three or four moves ahead. There was a goal he scored against Liverpool last season in the match they won 2-1, I think. And he darted into the near post, basically trapped the ball dead to kind of bounce it back up again and then span and hit a shot straight into the roof of the net. And it happened in a split second. And I think he darted in front of Dejan Lovren, maybe. And you just thought he knew exact that whole move when the ball was out wide. He knew everything that was about to happen. And to execute it, I think that's his greatest strength to me.
I think it's just kind of psychology too, though. And you know, there's something about when you see a top striker like that, and they look so, and it's balance as well. He plants his foot and gets the perfect strike on the football. And you see so many players, and crikey, I've done it myself. You're through in goal, and the rush of blood. And you're sort of almost falling over as you strike the ball.
Does it come into your head then? I know you were a defender, but in those moments, does it come into your mind?
Completely different circumstance
than anything
else. You're thinking,
oh God, I'm running on goal. Oh God, oh God, oh God, what am I going to do?
You should have seen me playing in my Vets team last week. Yeah. Within 50 yards of goal, yeah, feel the rush of blood. No, but I think it is. It's that. You know, we've seen it. Yeah, Michael Owen had it at his pomp. Obviously, that sort of ability to keep cool, even as you say, you're feeling that this is my moment. This is my moment. But I think also, and that sometimes can take that coolness and the ability to sort of delay and sort of slow down time. Other times, I think actually one of his great strengths has just been getting shots off quickly. Because I think so many, you know, rather than allowing defenders or goalkeepers to set themselves. You know, the Brazilian Ronaldo used to do it all the time as well, almost toe-poke it to get a shot off early because half the time defenders, or particularly goalkeepers, weren't expecting it. And if you just get, especially having the short backlift that Aguero seems to, just that ability to poke a shot off, and it doesn't have to be a pretty shot, but if you get it off that fraction of a second quicker than is expected, that often is enough to make an ordinary shot go in.
Is it just lastly on this, is there something to be said about the fact that he's dealt with competition? Gabriel Jesus obviously was brought in a few seasons ago as the next best thing. He didn't wilt because of that. He didn't urge to leave the club. He stuck at it. He was committed to the club. And actually, in some ways, he's become even a better player. Is there something that can be said about that mentality, that strength within him as well?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Jesus, he was almost kind of, we were speaking about him probably going to be eased out of the football club at that stage with Guardiola as well. Yeah. Didn't think, look like he was going to fit into that style of play. And he's kind of, he looks leaner, he looks fitter, he's adapted his game.
Not sure about the haircut, mind you.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm in no position to talk about it, I know, but the bleach blonde I thought went out in about 1987, but anyway.
I don't know, have you seen Ollie Mears recently? It's coming back in, obviously.
I like it, I think it's great.
Right. Eddie Howe is second favourite behind Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to be the next Premier League manager sacked after Bournemouth were the latest side to fall to a resurgent Watford under Nigel Pearson. In his programme notes ahead of the game, Howe had stated that this match marks the start of a season-defining period for the club. It was, though, a tepid showing from Howe's men, full of mistakes, as Watford took full advantage to secure a 3-0 away win. It means Howe is in the worst run of his managerial career, Bournemouth having won only twice in the league since September the 20th. And their only good results during a long slump have been against Chelsea, Arsenal and Manchester United. That may sound good, but when you're at the bottom, you should be winning against those teams who are around you. So, does anyone here think that Bournemouth should pull the plug now on Eddie Howe to survive potentially in the Premier League? Tom?
Well, I mean, if to survive in the Premier League, then you could argue yes. But it comes down to what you want from your club. I mean, you look at Bournemouth and you look at Eddie Howe. If they did get relegated, he could keep the nucleus of that squad, turn them around and they'd get promoted again, maybe win the championship quite comfortably. But, you know, we're in this period now of knee-jerk reactions, and I think it's an interesting time for Bournemouth to look at clubs over the last 10 years, people like Stoke, you know, with Tony Pulis, they'd been in the Premier League for a long time, had a way of playing that was quite effective, then had a season where they didn't start so well. And then they basically started, you know, chasing their tail by making appointments to survive, didn't work, eventually get relegated, and now they find themselves near the bottom of the Championship. I'm not saying that would happen with Bournemouth if they did sack Eddie Howe, but there's a choice to be made, I think, between short-term improvement, which mm-hmm. they might well get from bringing in a new manager. You know, we see it all the time. But whether that would actually last, because you then need to give a manager time to put his imprint on the club. And it would take a long time because Eddie Howe's been at Bournemouth for such a long time. I personally wouldn't sack him, but if you're asking, should you get rid in order to survive this season, I think you could make a case to do so, yeah.
It's interesting. A lot of people will refer to what's happened at Watford as a good case in point. You know, they sacked two managers. Now they brought in Nigel Pearson and they are going on a great run at the moment. But obviously Watford are a team, Matt, who are quite used to making change, whereas Bournemouth aren't, with Eddie Howe being the longest serving Premier League manager, has been there since October 2012. Where do you sit on the situation with Howe?
Yeah, as you say, Watford is a different model. I mean, I think a key thing would be sitting down with Eddie Howe himself and getting an honest answer about whether he thinks... Because I sat down with him at the end of, just after the end of last season, and I was just really struck by, you know, the players had all swanned off to Las Vegas or wherever the footballer goes these days. But he was there in his office, debriefing all his staff, going through stats. You know, and I'm not saying he deserves a, you know, halo for this, because it's what you'd expect from highly paid top flight managers. But he spoke then about, you know, he thought he would know when it was time to go, because he would felt he walked onto the training pitch and didn't think he had anything left to teach them. And I'd be really surprised if he's gone from what sounded to me like a guy who was ready to rebuild Bournemouth again, to look at weaknesses of last season, work out how to improve on those, and to keep building. I'd be really surprised if you went from that, what struck to me as someone who was as dedicated as ever, to someone who has sort of lost their way. I mean, clearly some things are not working out. You know, the signing of Solanke struck me as a sort of, you know, shrewd move at the time. It's not looking that way. You know, they've dried up the goals. I think they're just the joint bottom scorers in the division. There's you know, there's clear problems here. But I just think, you know, Eddie Howe, provided Eddie Howe is coming to work feeling like he has still got something to teach them, I'd think it would be daft to pull the trigger. I mean, I'm more surprised that actually other clubs haven't come in for him than, you know.
But that sort of has all dried up, hasn't it? That talk of Eddie Howe moving on.
I mean, you know, there is a good managers can, you know, sort of spells can run out of steam. I mean, you know, for very different reasons at Spurs. We saw that Pochettino, I think, is a brilliant manager, but it almost felt like that regime had run its course for lots of complicated reasons, including signings and politics and so on. Yeah, I did not start this season thinking the Eddie Howe regime at Bournemouth had sort of reached a point of sort of sterility. Unless he thinks that, I think they've got to stick with him.
I played against the Bournemouth team that he kept in the league against all odds with a points deduction. I played against the team in League One as well, where, you know, there's still some of these players playing. The one thing you would say is that he's had a kind of core of those players that have been on that journey, and it feels very much like it's coming to the end for them. Mm. You know, they're reliant on Simon Francis at the moment, who's turns 35 next month and just come back from an ACL. Steve Cook, he's probably the only one who's, you could see there's a bit of a future left. Yeah. Charlie Daniels is injured. There's not many of them left, and they've been a kind of a foundation of that club's journey. But Eddie, the journey has only happened because Eddie Howe is there. And they're not, I agree with Tom, you got to think what you want from your club. Where are they going to find a progressive coach with such a love and connection to Bournemouth, which is an important thing for fans as well, I think, where they don't exist. So it's just whether Maxim Denham shares that belief or not. You know, I agree as well, if it's about staying in the Premier League, then there definitely is a case, and what's happened with Nigel Pearson suggests that. But I think there's more important things than just staying in the Premier League.
But also, like, yeah, they have, you know, he has transformed. I mean, you know, this is, they're almost two separate debates. First is just acknowledging the amazing job he's done, and it is amazing, as you say. It took him over there 91st in the league. I think it's was it 11? That was 11 odd years ago. you know, everything at that club has been transformed since then. The expectations, I mean, they're currently, again, which is why I didn't get the impression it was running out of steam. The new training ground that, you know, and he is involved in that, down to, you know, choosing the colour of the paint and the, you know, the furnishings. I mean, it's part, you know, that's one of the reasons why he has insisted, you know, he's not constantly looking at his phone wondering why Everton or someone else haven't been in for him, because he feels there is a job to do there beyond picking a team every Saturday. Mm. You know, he has transformed it, absolutely.
Gregor, I'm just interested in your point about, you're talking about the players and the two groups. If you're either the kind of core group with a manager who's been there for a while, is it harder to kind of motivate, or, you know, think, you know, this guy, he's been telling me his ideas for 5 years. Do you think that plays on, you know, gets in the players?
No, that's not what I mean. I mean that there's a lot of new players coming in, and these guys are the ones who, it's almost a bit like Leicester. They've had, you know, a group of players, and we've heard them speaking about almost sort of telling the new players that are coming in about how the value of sort of team spirit and the journey that they've been on, which has been remarkable. And it's a similar thing that's happened at Bournemouth. So they're sort of edging out the door gradually means they're probably not quite as invested in the kind of future of Bournemouth. Yeah. And that could be something that's playing on sort
it
of...
It counts against.
Yeah.
But I mean, Matt, you know the powers of being football better than most of us. Money talks, doesn't it? That's the other thing. And you could argue, you know, the fear of dropping down to the Championship, not the Premier League money. That's where a lot of these short-term fixes come, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's fear more than logic.
Yeah.
In most cases, it's panic. And as I say, I think it would be it hardly strikes you as what Bournemouth have been built on to panic. As you say, that doesn't mean to say, you know, Eddie Howe should not be under a huge amount of scrutiny. This is not to say the question shouldn't be being, you know, actively asked in the boardroom there, as here. But I just think it's you know, I think the sort of the first big crisis of their Premier League existence, you know, does not strike me as the time to do it without, you know, giving it a bit longer yet, that's for sure.
Just going back to what Matt said about his kind of work ethic, I spent a day at Bournemouth training ground a couple of years ago and watched them train, and it was remarkable. I'd never seen such kind of detail and intensity. Him and all his staff went out like an hour before training was starting, and they went through every drill, and they'd maybe move a cone about 6 inches. Such fine detail about everything, and there was little things like kind of screens on the walls in the canteen, and every game, every session, there would be a photo taken of the winning team, and that would be transferred. So when you're eating your lunch afterwards, you have to stare at the winning team. You know, little things about just sort of taking things on to kind of spur on the team and motivate them. He's always thinking. So I think if anyone is kind of working hard and to find the reasons about how to make this better, it's him. And I wouldn't write them off yet either.
Well, they are, 2 points off safety in 19th then in the relegation zone. Just a final word on Bournemouth. Bear in mind the form that they're in. Can any of you see, I mean, I know Gregor, you said don't write them off just yet. Do you think they can turn it around?
I think they can. I mean, we would have said that Watford were down and out a few weeks ago. I mean, injuries have been a real issue for them this year. David Brooks, Josh King in particular. Callum Wilson just hasn't been scoring goals. Chris Meppham's now out for a considerable spell, so they have had a tough time with injuries this year, but I wouldn't write them off yet. I think they've got the capability to win enough games.
And if the worst was to happen and they were to be relegated, would you suggest they still stick with him? Because history has shown, Sean Dyche, obviously Burnley were relegated a few seasons ago with him at the helm. He stayed at the club and then got them immediately back up again.
Mm. I mean, that was my point. I think that you either sack him now, or you say, okay, well, this is your project. You know, the guys have talked in detail about everything he's given to the club and everything he's got prepared. But you then have to say, okay, well, if we do go down, then we keep you and you have a season in the Championship to try and get us back up. I think it's either, you know, sack him now or leave him for the next 18 months.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
What a weekend we had in the Championship. Before we, of course, have to talk about Brentford. Gregor, we're going to start with the top two, Leeds and West Brom. Both dropping points this weekend, both on a bad run of form. Surely Leeds can't blow it again this season.
They can.
Say they were beaten, obviously, weren't they, by Sheffield Wednesday?
Yes. Yeah, 2-0. It wasn't a smash and grab either, although the goals both came, I think it was 87th and 94th minute. Mm-hmm. Wednesday did have some chances, but again, it was the same old story. Leeds have dominated, and their record of taking chances and their shot conversion rate is just abysmal. Mm-hmm. I had a look on Opta as well, actually, and I think 9.9% shot conversion rate, which is the 16th in the Championship. So, you know, they dominate every metric. Possession, passing accuracy, even the number of shots they have, they don't have anyone to stick the ball in the back of the net. And it was the same last season. They were almost exactly the same numbers last season. So unless that changes this month, then it's going to be tight, I think. There's talk of Che Adams from Southampton. They need someone else after Eddie Nketiah went back to Arsenal. He obviously couldn't dislodge Patrick Bamford, who does a lot for the team, but he's not been prolific for Leeds. He has been in the past, so you know I wouldn't write him off either. But I just think that unless that changes, nothing's going to change for Leeds.
Goodness me. Well, what about West Brom then? They were held at the Valley by Charlton in the second meeting between the two sides in the space of a week. What's going wrong for them with their run of form?
That's a bit harder to call, actually. I mean, similar to Leeds, they went on a really good run. I think Leeds won 7 in a row and West Brom won 6 in a row. And now they've kind of, both of them have really, their form's fallen off the edge of a cliff. But I think the key difference with them is they have the firepower. I think, you know, they've got strikers who can share the goals around. Charlie Austin, R. Robson Kanu, Matt Phillips, they're all on 7 goals, which is not, you know, it's not prolific by any stretch, but the three of them are all scoring goals. And it's this kind of different dynamic to last season when they relied upon Gio Rodriguez and Dwight Gayle. I think they have got the firepower to stay the distance. But Brentford are the ones that are kind of creeping up behind them, and I see you getting excited there, yeah.
I know, I get a bit nervous just thinking about it, if I'm quite honest. Yeah, we were 3-1 winners over QPR in the final derby, West London derby, to be played at Griffin Park in the early kickoff on Saturday. It was all down to BMW once again.
Even scored an order.
I know. How handy is that? I know. It was a really entertaining game if you're a Brentford fan, of course. Although I must give a little bit of credit to QPR because I thought they started the game really well and I thought we're in for a game here. But as soon as we scored, they kind of fell apart. And defensively, QPR are very fragile, it seems.
Easy to be nice when you've won.
Oh, of course. Of course. But still, I mean, I think that is one of the bigger problems for QPR defensively. They've been chipping quite a few goals.
As a QPR season ticket holder, it's... I guess it's never dull. It's either 6-0 or feels like 0-6. You know, Mark Warburton's got a team trying to play some lovely football, some lovely ball players, Chair and Eze and so on. Mm. But they are just oddly, weirdly flimsy. As soon as a team starts to sort of make them wobble, they don't just wobble, they crumble defensively. And it's something you just can't quite fix. It's not dull.
The thing about Brentford, you know, we're talking about the BMW roaring and all sorts, but they've now got the best defensive record in the league as well. So, you know, they're doing it at both ends, which is sort of a bit ominous, really, for the rest of the league, I think. So I think if there is one team to
You're trying your best to jinx them. I can see.
I don't like this talk.
It's different to last season. No, the last few seasons, I think they've always finished in the top half. They've always threatened the playoffs. They signed Janssen and Pinnock from Barnsley as well. Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of Janssen, I'll be honest. I thought he was a liability at times for Leeds, but he's been a leader that they've kind of lacked.
It's so funny because I when we signed him, obviously it was quite a coup and a lot of Brentford fans were delighted, a lot of Leeds fans were upset. But I do remember thinking, he's not all that. Like you thought, yeah. I thought he had rickets in him every now and then. But he has just brought an experience that we've lacked for a long time.
It's a very
time.
Young team, you know, they're all in their kind of early 20s. So, no, it does look pretty good for Brentford at the moment.
Well, last week on the pod, we spoke about the teams that we would like to see go up. I obviously stood back from this one, Matt. But while you're here, can you give us who you'd like to see go up?
Well, Queen's Park Rangers. But I'm willing to accept that's over-ambitious. I got my sort of grounding in football at Elland Road. I was 7 years old and went to my first 4 years of watching football as a Leeds fan before moving from the city. So I guess I feel some little historic alliance with them. So yeah, I think Bielsa is one of, you know, I think we almost underestimate just how much he is one of football's most fascinating characters. You know, this is someone that Guardiola, Pochettino talk about with reverence. You know, obviously we've seen his little sort of eccentricities, the whole Spygate thing. And, well, he managed to go from Spygate to winning the Fair Play Award last year, which is, you know, this is a guy who's a fascinating coach, fascinating character. And the lead story, you know, traced again that whole, you know, the sort of almost reaching a Champions League final, then, you know, plummeting through the divisions with financial mayhem. I think the lead story is always been an interesting one, and I'm sorry Brentford for saying that. Not West London
it's
rivalry
all right.
at all. In
no,
Baltimore.
No, I, exactly. I'm, you're just bitter. Anyway,
we don't want to see Fulham go up either.
No, we definitely don't want to see Fulham go up. Definitely not. Right, now let's talk about an interesting incident that happened in Spain. The Atletico Madrid coach Diego Simeone said Federico Valverde's professional foul on Alvaro Morata on the Spanish Super Cup for Real Madrid, but refused to condemn the Uruguayan for his actions. Valverde was shown a straight red card in the 115th minute of the final after deliberately tripping Morata. And I think it's fair to say it's a definite deliberate foul anyway.
Trip is polite.
I think trip is very polite. Hacked him down, should we say?
Yeah. Like it,
when the Atletico striker was clean through. With the tie scoreless and only 5 minutes of extra time left, a goal then would likely have seen Atletico lift the trophy, but instead Real went on to claim the spoils with a 4-1 win on penalties. So, Diego Simeone says he hasn't done anything wrong. Do we find that astonishing that he actually came out and said what he said, Tom?
I mean, it says a lot that it is Simeone himself. This is the kind of move he would have done, and you know, walked off the pitch probably grinning from ear to ear. I mean, it's also the kind of move that if a player on your team does it, he's a hero forever. If it happens against you, there is, you know, you're so enraged that, you know, I mean, I'd have to probably take myself off to cool down and leave the stadium. You know, and that you saw that in the reaction of a lot of the Atletico players, even though the referee sent him straight off. You know, Valverde was like, head down, yep, you know, took one for the team, I'll see you later. You know, there's so much rage in that moment. Yeah, I think if you were looking at it, taking out the fan passion bit, I don't think it's great. And I think there could be something done with this kind of a, you know, real cynical foul. That could be looked at. I mean, this is a kind of straight red card one, but you see them quite a lot. I mean, I always remember Ander Herrera against Liverpool. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been Emre Can, and, you know, it was one of those classic United, I think under Mourinho, performances of about 10 behind the ball. And, you know, midfielder turned away from him and Herrera just held on to his shirt. You know, it was like a kind of kid trying to stop his dad leaving for work because he wanted to play with him. He just like... pleading with him to not to run away from him, and got a yellow card. I mean, I think you could easily argue for something to be done about that.
I have argued I have argued for sin bins on the, I mean, at least say, at least this one gets a red card. I think, as you say, the more annoying is, you know, if less dramatic is those, you know, the tactical fouls that we talk about so often and see are pretty much just par for the course for most teams now. Of, you know, and what is more exciting in football than a thrilling counter attack? And how many thrilling counter attacks have been, you know, strangled at birth by some tactical foul? And I say, I think there should, yeah, there is a cause for looking at an orange card in those circumstances. But say at least this gets a red. We're talking about that, you know, this goes, which, and the reason it gets a red, as the oldest man in the room, is because 1980 Cup final, Paul Allen, I'm pretty sure it is, youngest player I think ever to have played in a FA Cup final at that point, is through for West Ham, and Willie Young comes flying in and sizes him down, you know, no attempt or hope of playing the ball, and, you know, gets up, gets a yellow card, and on the game goes. And that was the point where football said, hang on a minute, there's no way that is appropriate sanction. So, you know, they did upgrade it from yellow card to red card for the professional foul. But yeah, if how you can do more than that is
I mean, there's a grinning former pro who happened to be a defender sitting at the other end.
Do anything similar, Gregor?
Look, before I say this, it was nowhere near as brutal. This guy just volleyed him in the leg. So, but yeah, when I was at Forest, I think it was in 2004, we played Sunderland at the City Ground just after Christmas. And it was 1-1, 80th minute, and we had a corner, which I was back for. And it got kind of half cleared, and Andy Reid controlled the ball. He was facing away from goal, so I pulled wide to kind of say, lay the ball to me and I'll stick it back in the box. He tried a Cruyff turn, lost the ball. I think it was Julio Arca set off Chris Brown, big lump of a striker who Mick McCarthy loved. So I was hearing back after this guy. And it got to about the D of the penalty area, and I was pretty sure I wasn't going to get the ball, but I went for it anyway, slid in. Took him out, straight red. And it was a free kick. And it was one of those, you go back down the tunnel, and I kind of was peering over, and it was Arca taking a free kick, and he hit the bar.
Ooh.
I was thinking,
he was well known for set pieces, wasn't he?
Okay, so I'm back in the changing room, and then 90th minute, I hear the roar from the away end, and Marcus Stewart went off.
So it wasn't even worth it?
It wasn't worth it in the end. But not dissimilarly to Simeone, Mick Hartford, who's no shrinking violet either, was our sort of caretaker manager then. And he came in and said, did what you had to do.
So I was terrified.
Even though you'd lost, no teammates were like...
He was 1-1 with through on goal. And if, you know, you take him out, you think you can defend for 10 minutes. He thinks it was the kind of the better of...
Yeah.
You took one for the team, literally.
Yeah. I mean, I was terrified. I thought I was going to get all sorts of abuse. But
so no fine?
Nothing. The offer of a new deal, even.
But isn't that part of the problem, which you alluded to a little bit earlier on, Tom, in the fact that if you're the fan of that player who makes the tackle and he wins the tackle even though he's taken down the player, so he's fouled the opposition, you're there going, yeah, great tackle, you know, and you're there even saying, take him out. That is part of the problem, isn't it, our own psyche?
I think so. You know, as Dicko said before, you know, the excitement of a counter-attack, you lose all this in football, don't you? Because you become blindly partisan towards your own team. But, you know, there was one, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, as well as scoring loads of goals for Man United, there was a moment in the title race, I think in 98, against Newcastle, Rob Lee cleaned through at Old Trafford, 1-1, and Solskjaer sprinted back and just hacked him. And I think he'd only been on about 5 minutes, I think I checked, before he came on as a super sub to try and score the goal. And he got a standing ovation from Old Trafford for taking a red card, and they drew 1-1. And then the other one I think of, which the one which comes even, you know, really close to the line in terms of you know, questionable decisions, is the Suarez handball against Ghana in the World Cup, because I think Asamoah Gyan missed the penalty, and that's when Suarez had the moment you didn't have, Gregor, of being in the tunnel and watching it and then cheering manically, and he's like, yes, it was worth it. So do you give them a longer ban?
It doesn't matter. It's a red trophy at stake, you know, and that was a final. It's kind of, I don't think it matters in the end. It's part of the game.
I suppose the biggest issue as well is the fact that we call it tactical foul. Yeah. It sounds like it's all right to do it. Does it not? It
always has been, yeah. Still, you know, I think really, you can't go any further with the punishments unless it's unless it's really brutal. And this guy was brutal, I think. If this was this was a league game, there was some force behind that. You know, he could have broken his leg. Yeah. But I think it's part of the game. It always has been.
And just when you thought we might be able to do a podcast without talking about VAR, well, you'd be wrong. We have a Premier League player speaking out, claiming players do not want it in the league. That is West Ham midfielder Declan Rice, who made the claim after his side were denied a late equaliser at Sheffield United due to the ball hitting his arm in the build-up. This is what Rice said. I think they are the thoughts of every Premier League player, not just me. Pretty much everyone doesn't want VAR in the game. There have been so many decisions this season that have been absolutely crazy. They were celebrating VAR in reference to the Sheffield United fans like it was a goal, and football should not be like that. And we've discussed VAR a lot on this podcast, but we appear to be left in a bit of a chicken or the egg scenario with it and the handball law. The law regarding handball states any goal scored or created with the use of the hand or arm will be disallowed, even if it is accidental. And that's now led to many calling for IFAB to change the handball law so that a goal like West Ham's would have stood on Friday night. Are people right to be calling for a change in the handball law, Matt?
Well, I certainly think it's a part, you know, it has to be discussed because, you know, it's been one of the consequences of VAR that obviously they're more detectable and there's because of that, IFAB thought they were bringing in a greater clarity by having this sort of, if it touches the arm, it's ruled out. And so I can imagine at the time seemed like a logical move. I think that the trouble is that like this, with this and with the a lot of the offside rulings, there is the perception that VAR is sort of ruling out lots of goals that would have stood and that it's sort of, there's a joy-killing perception to it. I think that's harsh on VAR system because the VAR, you know, ultimately the issue is more there with the rules and, you know, how we are calibrating the rules. And I think, you know, I can understand that they need to be looked at more. But I think to sort of use those frustrations as a proof that VAR is rubbish and that VAR has to be scrapped strikes me as a sort of illogical way of evolving the argument. If you want to change the rules, fine. But the idea that makes VAR, say, the problem strikes me as crackers.
I think we saw that in the interviews afterwards. I thought the Sky Sports interview was very good. He gave both Rice and Moyes the opportunity very clearly to sort of put a dividing line between VAR and the rule of handball, and neither took it. They just damned VAR by association, really. Yeah. And I think that is the overwhelming feeling, you know. As Rice said, kind of a lot of people are feeling very negatively about VAR, but it is the rule. I thought that was very telling, those interviews. They kind of, Moyes, I thought Moyes would actually differentiate between the two, but he didn't. He just saying that we need to kind of roll back on VAR, which is not the case. It's the rules.
But it's a bit of a moment, isn't it, when a player speaks out? I mean, Matt, in your camp of pro VAR, when you're all sat around trying to think of ways to save it,
me and Mike Riley. Is anyone else in the room? I'm not sure.
I think you've got a couple more fans. But I mean, no. Did you see that and think, well, you know, that? Because to me, when a current player speaks out so prominently in this day and age, when fans can interact on social media and, you know, retweet and like in, you know, and all that kind of stuff. That's quite a moment, isn't it?
Well, it is a moment, but like Gregor says, it's not necessarily logic. You know, he's speaking in the emotion of it, and not you know. I mean, it's, you know, never cease to be amazed how many, you know, players, coaches, whatever, don't even know the rules of the game.
Well, this is the impression I got from these interviews, but I don't, you know, they were in the heat of the moment. He was very emotional about it, but it didn't seem like Rice understood the difference between.
and they know, you know, they're emotional and they know that it, you know, to their fans, it'll be, yeah, too right, you know, it's a disgrace, it's a disgrace. And it's fueling, you know, there's been, you know, and no one comes to football for calm logic, perhaps, but that's, you know, it's been part of my argument the whole way through this, is that has VAR got a chance? Because, you know, we seem to come to football to sort of, you know, howl out our frustrations, and people don't seem to have that little bit of patience to go, well, actually, this does make the referee's life a bit easier, or it does make the game a little fairer or a little more accurate. People are just too busy going, you know, we have a culture of screaming, disputing, raging about decisions.
Does Rice have a point, though, with regards to when he says they were celebrating VAR like it was a goal and football should not be like that?
But that's, you know, you go to other sports, you go to tennis, you know, there's a ball, you know, they're tracking the ball in Hawkeye and there's like the, you know, there's almost a build-up of excitement about it. It's the same with cricket. In, you know, it becomes part of the drama, which, you know, in football, can it become, you know, if it becomes part of the occasion, I mean, I said I don't see people necessarily complaining about that in pretty much every other sport in which technology
is
being
used. Part of the problem, though, because you know, in cricket, LBW decision, you see the ball tracking go on, it's either, you know, hitting the stumps or not. Tennis, it's either in or it's out. You know, if you flashed up a handball thing, you and I'd be sat there and I might go, that's not handball, and you'd go, well, it's definitely handball.
But that's, you know,
I know that's your point about that's the law and that's not VAR.
Well, that's where we're having to adjust to it. And again, also, everyone is, you know, God, I'm sort of backing myself in, because, you know, the system is, you know, you've got to accept it's not pleasing a lot of people. But, you know, equally, always, yeah, maybe I'll be saying this in 10 years' time from now and shoot me if I am, but it does seem like no one's given themselves time to readjust to a new system. I mean, maybe, you know, all this stuff can be changed or is being changed, or it requires a adjustment of perception or how we might, you know, I don't think it ruins football. I think it might just take us a little bit of time, if we've got it, to just to reacquaint ourselves with a different way of judging a few things, or, you know, but does anyone have time for that in football?
I mean, seeing what, you know, those moments like David Moyes running off down the touchline, or Man City last year when Sterling scored, I think it was against Liverpool and Guardiola.
That was a heck
of a moment.
People talk about it as a passion killer. That was amazing.
So, yeah, that's incredible. The only thing is, when you see someone score and they're hesitant about celebrating, that feels wrong. That feels like something has been taken away from the game there. And they're not that often, but there has been instances. You know, I think Johnny Evans scored at the weekend and he kind of knew that he was half a yard offside and he was going to run off. People were trying to celebrate and he's like, I think we need to wait and check here. So I'm not sure about that. That's kind of, I think really we've just got to balance up between having, knowing that you've got that kind of, that joy, and knowing that you're going to get closer to the right decisions. And we're on a journey with it. It's not...
Well, exactly. And it's a journey that is going to get, you know, there may be something in the paper, hopefully, in the next day or three about this, about how we potentially can make things quicker. Because, you know, that's, again, we're, you know, in the great scheme of things, we're still pretty early days with all this. And, you know, technology is moving all the time. Are there ways of automating systems better that can make it all quicker? I mean, I'm all for that. I'm all for improving this. I'm not sitting there thinking, even as someone who thinks, you know, we've got to stick with VAR, I'm not here thinking it's perfect or can't be amended and improved a heck of a lot from here.
Well, VAR did have its say in the big game of the weekend at Spurs. Andy Robertson followed through heavily on Jafet Tanganga in Liverpool's 1-0 win, and fans think he was lucky to escape a red card. Robertson planted his studs on Tanganga's ankle, and despite winning the ball, his boot was high and fans were shocked that the incident wasn't reviewed by VAR. Obviously, you had Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang being sent off for some saying similar situation in the game at Crystal Palace. Anyone surprised at this incident involving Robertson not being red carded?
Well, I think it was the right decision.
Yeah? Not a red card for you?
No. I mean, he won the ball. And there was no way of winning the ball without and then stopping completely abruptly and not making contact with, you know, yes, you can say it's dangerous and slightly reckless, but that's the only way he could win the ball, I think. So it wasn't a red card for me. And I think that, you know, there was a lot of images doing the rounds on social media of this still frame of his studs planted on the Spurs player's shin. But that, you know, it's completely out of context. And that's the thing, that is one thing that VAR is perhaps doing as well. It's slightly altering our perception of certain aspects of the game, because when you look at things back, it looks very different. But I think they got the right decision there.
So that wasn't a red card for you. Speaking of Tottenham against Liverpool, Tom, were you surprised Mourinho didn't manage to spoil Liverpool's day? The reason I mention that is because of this prediction that you made on Thursday.
I'm a bit of a romantic, but is there anything more Jose Mourinho than beating Liverpool in this game without Harry Kane.
I could see a Tottenham, even like a 2-1, 2-0 win. It's set up for Mourinho to produce an upset that would stop, you know, Liverpool ticking that box of a season unbeaten. You know, it's made for him, I think.
Yeah, that worked out.
All right. Yeah, get the sports editor on the podcast and embarrass him. I see. Right, look, you know, it was only 1-0 for a start.
Mm-hmm, true.
They played very well in the second half, I thought. And you can't, you know, that's the only way to beat Liverpool, I think, at the minute. They're so good. And I think Liverpool are a team that if you go at them and try and play them at their own game, they're going to absolutely destroy you. I mean, I not want to try and defend myself with statistics, but that's exactly what I'm about to do. The only team that have come close to beating Liverpool this season is Manchester United at home. 32% possession, 2 shots on target. Marcus Rashford manages to score one of them. They nearly hung on to win 1-0. Spurs v Liverpool, 33% possession, 4 shots on target. Only downside was that they conceded first.
They also let Liverpool make almost 800 passes, which is the most at White Hart Lane, I think, ever. So it's quite a chastening shift for Spurs from the Pochettino era to the Mourinho era already. I'm not sure how long the Spurs fans will be happy with that if they're not getting results.
Yeah. Want to give us a bold prediction for this week, Tom?
I mean, this is almost certainly going to be wrong as well, but given how bad the first leg was between Manchester United and Wolves, I'll say that the replay will involve a couple of goals and that Man United might even win, which I think counts as a shock these days, doesn't it? United beating Wolves.
Right.
So, you know, that's almost certainly
a kind of sound like you're sitting on the fence a little bit with that one, though.
All right, 4-0 Man United.
Okay, we will wait to see if that happens. That is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Matt Dickinson and Tom Clark.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Thursday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat your cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.